Now, it's no coincidence that many visitors to the Czech capital leave with a Franz Kafka t-shirt as a souvenir. Kafka is undisputedly Prague's most famous literary son, and in today's Czech Books, David Vaughan talks to a Canadian academic about Kafka and how he interacted with his home city.
As Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a gigantic insect. He was lying on his hard, as it were, armor-plated back, and when he lifted his head a little, he could see his dome-like brown belly divided into stiff, arched segments, on top of which the bedquilt could hardly keep in position and was about to slide off completely. His numerous legs, which were pitifully thin compared to the rest of his bulk, waved helplessly before his eyes.
The opening paragraph of Franz Kafka's story Metamorphosis is one of the most famous in world literature. But the writer himself will always be something of an enigma. Kafka was born in Prague in 1883 and spent nearly all his life in the city, dying at just 41 in a sanatorium near Vienna. A Kafka symposium was recently held in the Czech capital, and one of the most interesting talks was given by the American-born Canadian academic Anthony Northey. For many years, he's been trying to piece together details of Kafka's biography, and has also been researching into the way Kafka interacted with his home city, at a time when Prague was going through rapid and dynamic change. He has managed to challenge some of the many myths that have become both the blessing and the curse of Prague's most famous literary son. When I met Anthony Northey, he began by telling me more about his research into Kafka's Prague.
I've been at this now for 34 years. You know, when you discover something, when you discover a new little tidbit, and it's part of a great mosaic, you know, that you start to put together little pieces, you see that you can complete the image of Kafka a little bit more.
And talking about the image of Kafka, I mean, he is so much one of the icons of 20th century literature. There's always the danger, isn't there, that the myth of Kafka becomes more important almost than the writings themselves or the person of Kafka as well.
Yes, unfortunately we have, or I mean many people say unfortunately, many Kafka scholars say unfortunately we have this word Kafkaesque. Now it usually means anything bureaucratic, red tape, it means anything somber, bizarre. It has come to mean that, and then when the name Kafka is mentioned, people immediately think of those things. They think of the Kafkaesque, and that's unfortunate because that overstates completely what Kafka and misstates what Kafka wanted to say with a lot of his work.
One thing that's very interesting from the point of view of Prague is that Kafka was writing in German, and Czechs have always had a rather complicated relationship to Kafka's writing. Under the communist regime, it was for much of the time banned virtually altogether. Certainly there were very few editions of Kafka's writings that were published in the entire 40 years of communist rule. Also, he's been seen quite often as a German writer, therefore as not one of us. I know that a lot of your research has been focusing on putting Kafka very much into a Prague context and into the context of the reality of Prague of his time. Could you tell me a little bit more about this?
In hindsight, people misread history a little bit. I think once you get into it, you realize that Germans and Czechs were not always at each other's throats. There was a certain amount of coexistence, and especially among intellectuals. Many of the things that just existed in Prague took place in Prague, and that really belonged to his life. And many of these things were shared between Germans and Czechs. For example, the big exposition that was held in 1908.
This was a major industrial exhibition.
It was
wasn't
a major
celebrating
industrial,
industry in the region.
Exhibition, yes. I mean, it was meant actually as a regional exposition, but it turned out to be much larger, and it involved a lot of, things that fascinated Kafka, too. I mean, he was fascinated, of course, by exotic things, and this exposition had brought in some Abyssinians, and they'd set up a little village, and they had performed ceremonies and things like that, which fascinated him. There was this Japanese tea house, and he says to Max Brod, yes, we've got to go back to the exposition and see the geishas again, you know.
And there was also a lot of new technology, wasn't there?
The first incubator was shown to save young premature babies. There was even an outdoor cinema that was projected on the wall of one of the buildings, apparently. You could ascend in a hot air balloon and view the exposition from above and all kinds of things like that. The enthusiasm really went from top to bottom. It went from old to young.
Of course, the key question as far as Kafka's writings is concerned is how does this interest come out in his short stories and in his novels?
In the novel America, which has a lot of biographical elements, the kernel of the story, it's really a young man who goes to America, and while he is there, he makes these discoveries, of course, of all these new things, and he's really overwhelmed, in a way, by the new world. In fact, you might say he even gets, during the course of the novel, he seems to get younger and younger and younger because he cannot cope with the new world. But a lot of the new world is a matter of technology. I mean, the automobiles are described as these incessant streams of cars going by, or then at one point he's viewing a room with telephone operators that are handling many calls that are coming in and going out.
People will often put writers in one of two camps, either those who embrace the new world and technology and innovation and the societal changes that come with it, other writers who will tend to be more nostalgic for the past. I have a feeling that Kafka doesn't fit neatly into either camp, does he?
No, and I think that's what probably makes him a good author, because he will accept, and at the same time he has reservations. Prague before the war was very lively, especially the competition between the Czechs and the Germans. I always compare Prague to, you know, it's a little bit like the Avis company when it was battling with Hertz and it came up with the slogan, "We try harder." Well, that's what Prague was. They tried harder. They had to fight between the giants like Vienna, of course, and Berlin on the other hand, and of course Paris, because the Czechs were very Francophile. And they had to kind of pull themselves up. They could, of course, never get up to the status of those cities, but they tried. They tried very, very hard.
I know that one thing that you've been looking into is Kafka's, as it were, social and cultural life in Prague. He was a keen theatergoer. He was a keen reader. He would go to bars, to cabarets. He would read all the latest cultural magazines voraciously. This, again, must have had a significant influence on his worldview.
Again, that made Prague the lively place it was. I'm particularly interested in Kafka's meeting up with popular culture, especially the variety theater in Prague and certain cabarets, because you have to realize that the acts in all these places, they came from abroad. Many of them came from France, from England, Italy, from North America, from South America, right?
And what sort of things were these?
For one, there were slapstick comedian acts, there were sort of juggling acts, there were balancing acts, but even singers. I think, because certain descriptions really indicate that Kafka probably experienced the beginnings of jazz. I mean, he experienced ragtime. Kafka was very interested in that. Remember, he did write this novella, The Hunger Artist, for example, and everyone says The Hunger Artist. My God, that must be certainly a figment of his bizarre imagination.
I think here we should explain. The hunger artist is it's literally an artist whose art is that he doesn't eat, isn't
he? He doesn't eat, right.
People go to see him.
Of course, in a typical Kafka fashion, he really cogitates about this and comes to the conclusion that he doesn't eat because he never liked to eat, and that's kind of cheating in some way. But he says, I never really cheated, I never ate, right? So it depends how you define cheating in this case. That goes back, really, to an actual hunger artist. There were actual hunger artists. Now, I didn't discover that, but I discovered the hunger artist that Kafka probably saw in Prague, a man by the name of Ricardo Sacco. He hungered for something like 40 days or publicly in one of these beer halls or something like that. And it was pretty much the way Kafka described it. So, you know, it's not his bizarre imagination. That was a real thing. Now, of course, you have to realize at the end of The Hunger Artist, he says, you know, the hunger artist sort of shrivels up into nothing and it almost blows away. And what takes over in his cage is a kind of wild animal that wants blood. And that's what the audience wants to see, is blood. So, I mean, Kafka, of course, is referring to the atmosphere that came in World War I.
"Well, clear this out now," said the overseer. And they buried the hunger artist, straw and all. Into the cage they put a young panther. Even the most insensitive felt it refreshing to see this wild creature leaping around the cage that had so long been dreary. The panther was all right. The food he liked was brought to him without hesitation by the attendants. He seemed not even to miss his freedom. His noble body, furnished almost to the bursting point with all that it needed, seemed to carry freedom around with it too. Somewhere in his jaws it seemed to lurk, and the joy of life streamed with such ardent passion from his throat that for the onlookers it was not easy to stand the shock of it. But they braced themselves, crowded around the cage, and did not want ever to move away.
And Prague has always been, and I think still is, a city where they love fads.
Oh, yeah. I think precisely during that time when you had such a, you know, a real plethora of tech, you know, technical things coming on the market, really, essentially. And it got people all enthused. And it was really part of internationalism because this transcended, I mean, of course, everyone is proud of their own aviators and proud of this. But in general, they were just proud of that now, you know, humankind is going to be progressing. It's going to go forward and things are going to be new. And we're having, you know, on the verge of a new world. I think perhaps some people even thought, you know, perhaps we're on the verge of a new humaneness. Unfortunately, they were sorely disappointed, of course, in 1914, because then technology was used in a much different way.
Anthony Northey, thank you very much for giving us so many fascinating insights into Kafka and the world that he lived in.
You're quite welcome.